Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gostola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to be joined this week by Todd Miller, who's the author of Empire of Borders, The Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World. He's also written two previous books, Storming the Wall, Border Patrol Nation. And he's a journalist who covers borders. We're really happy to have you on again. We've had Todd Miller on our show a few times prior to this episode, but it's great to be talking with you again after completing this really exceptional piece of work. So thanks, Todd.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate your words, and I'm very happy to be on your show again.
So just to set this up, what you did over the past 5 to 10 years is go on this kind of a journey that you take us through in the book of finding how the ruling classes, the elites, the people running different governments of the world, particularly in the most powerful countries around the world, like US, Europe, the Five Eyes nations, but then some of the other countries in the Middle East as well, and parts of Central America are doing work for these most powerful countries, and how this global border system is being erected. You write in your book that there are more than 77 border walls. There's billions upon billions of dollars worth of surveillance technology, including biometrics, and tens of thousands of armed agents guarding the dividing lines between the global north and global south. There are detention centers crammed with people. We've seen a lot of this. It's been magnified under President Donald Trump's administration, with more U.S. media coverage than ever before of what's going on at the border between U.S. and Mexico. But why don't you start by outlining this concept of a multi-layered border that the United States is most vividly creating between the United States and Mexico, but as you talk about it, extends deeper into the Central American region.
Yeah, to find that term, multi-layered, it's right. You just go right to the Customs and Border Protection Strategy papers. There it is. It's probably said a number of times. We have a multi-layered border policing strategy. And of course, one part of that is the internal expansion of the border into the interior of the United States, which we could also talk about. But the huge part of it is this internationalization of the border apparatus, this extension. You can look at it in a number of different ways. If looking, for example, in the 9/11 Commission report, one sentence kind of says it all. It said the U.S., or I have to paraphrase, unfortunately, but it says the U.S. homeland is the planet, right? So the idea of what does that mean in terms of homeland security, and this idea of quote unquote homeland security when the homeland quote unquote is the planet, and then thus you know comes you know the logic behind this multi-layered expansion, pushing out the border, as officials tend to say. And which makes us really have to reconceptualize what the U.S. border is, right? Because there's an intense amount of focus on the U.S.-Mexico border, and rightly so, right? But to only think that that's the only part of it is just a very limited way to think of it. When you think of all these multiple programs that have been developed to bring trainings and send resources, to install attaches and embassies around the world, to help other countries build up the border. But one of the easiest ways to explain it, though, is to look at the what's going on this side, in this hemisphere, and the idea, at least as officially stated, of pushing out the borders is so the U.S. apparatus can stop people or things from coming to the United States well before they even, you know, come close to coming, even getting close to the border. And one of the, you know, most vivid examples is the Mexican border with Guatemala, where for years and years and years now, the United States has been putting a lot of pressure, political pressure on Mexico to build up its border. But on top of that, there's a concept in what's known as the Merida Initiative, which is a military aid package that the United States really sends lots of money and resources to Mexico. The third pillar of the Merida Initiative is called the 21st Century Border. And through that program, the Merida Initiative started in 2008, and it's worth about $2 to $3 billion. And through that program, they've sent an intense amount of resources to Mexico. So it's been fortifying its borders. They've sent U.S. Border Patrol agents to Mexico to do trainings of its immigration officials, its army and soldiers, and its police units. And you could see that really palpably on the Mexico's southern border with Guatemala, where it's really, there's a gaunt, like if you cross that border, there's a literal gauntlet of checkpoints that one has to go through in order to travel. And most of them are immigration checkpoints. So if you don't have the proper documents, then you're going to be stopped and arrested and incarcerated and then expelled from Mexico, much like you would be in the United States. So it's very much following the same sort of, the strategy of the apparatus as we have in the United States. And one thing about that, it's been a quote unquote success, right? Because you look from 2015 on, when you see this real intensification of Mexican border fortification, Mexico has deported more people from Central America than the United States since then. So when we think about the U.S. southern border, you really have to think about this Mexican southern border with Guatemala as a layer of U.S. border, and how it's effectively doing the same sort of work, but it's way, way, way far away and often out of the eyes of the public.
You know, Todd, one thing that was really dramatic about your book, well, there's so many things, but one thing in particular that connects to what you're talking about is not just sort of like the funding for adding militarized equipment and checkpoints to borders, but also you talk about this like special operations unit of the Border Patrol that until I read it in your book, I'd never heard of. And you mentioned that no one's really heard of it. It's a weird acronym.
BORTAC.
It's like, yeah. It makes me think of Borat. So I can't really take it seriously. but it is a very serious unit that like goes around the world. And it's training these, I guess, border patrol people in other countries, and it's adding this very warlike aspect to borders, which also adds to militarizing it. But it really treating borders like everywhere, not just expanding the American border, but also like internationalizing the idea of borders being a front line in some sort of war. So I guess, can you talk about the special operations unit? What is it? What does it do? And can you speak to what I just mentioned about the whole idea of like turning borders into front lines and wars?
Yeah, sure. When I was one of the research trips, I actually start the book out this way. I went to a military base in Guatemala, in Zacapa, Guatemala. It's kind of on the Honduran borderlands, and I had an interview set up with a commander there for what is called the Chorti Border Force, which is it's pretty much the Guatemalan Border Patrol. Again, completely financed, trained. The supplies that they have come from the United States, the U.S. Embassy. So the U.S. Embassy's fingerprints were all over it. So I went there, but at the time I was just investigating, and I went to the military base, and I was 2 hours late. I was 2 hours late for many reasons, and I was 2 hours late to an interview is not the greatest thing, but I was trying to get from San Pedro Sula in Honduras to Zacapa, which I thought was going to take less time, and it didn't. So I got there, and I'm talking to the soldiers at the gate, and they started you know, I told them what I wanted to do. I wanted to interview the commander. And then they got on the phone. And then finally, one of the soldiers came over to me and he said, "Are you from Bortak?" And I went, what? What did you just ask me? I had to like make sure, like, he said the word Bortak. And I was like, seriously? Like, nobody in my own country knows what Bortak is. So here I am, like, 1,500 miles away from the United States border. And this Guatemalan soldier, probably 20 years old, is asking me, Bortak. You know, so Bortak is, you know, essentially the like you were saying, Rania, the SWAT, just like it's the Special Forces Unit of the U.S. Border Patrol. And on the border, it does, like, SWAT, like, you know, operations. And then it also a huge component of its mission is to go abroad and do trainings. And indeed, that was verified right from the start, right? They had been there, the Bortak, you know, the Bortak, I want to say, I almost want to say soldiers, right? Because they're like, they're trained like soldiers. They're like the Border Patrol, you know, in a way, all the Border Patrol is like a robo, it's a agency of robocops, but the Bortak is up to another level, right? They're like the elite, quote unquote, you know? And so that, you know.
Yeah, not to be confused with like a Central Asian dictator.
Right. Interesting thing to think about. I'll have to think about that later. But yeah, so the idea that this you know, Special Forces unit it's one part of this international apparatus that goes abroad. I mean, Bortak is the Border Patrol unit that does it, and they come up with the other CBP, and then you have you know, different elements of you know, this, because according to the Foreign Assistance Act, the only two departments that can give foreign assistance are the Department of Defense and the Department of State. So what Department of Homeland Security has to do is funnel all their international trainings basically through these two departments. So there's like over 100 programs that they can use between the DOD and the Department of State. And so you have like the INL, which is like the International Bureau on Law Enforcement and Narcotics, who you know, are really, you know, the Department of State part of it that's behind the training in Guatemala and other places in Central America. But then they fund Border Patrol, like Bortak, to come and do the trainings in Guatemala. And then, you know, among a number of other of like units. And lo and behold, right after that, you have a Border Patrol unit that's ready to go guard the international border with Honduras in this case. But in Guatemala's case, they have another one also with us through the same process that's guarding the border with El Salvador. And then they have another one that's on the border with Mexico. So it's like all, you know, all the borders in Guatemala have a Border Patrol unit. And then Honduras has them as well, right? So you keep going and going and going. And every country seems to have one of these units or some sort of border enforcement that has come from, you know, at least influenced by or comes directly from the United States. And one of the like interesting things I came across when I was interviewing CBP people in the International Affairs Department in Washington was that they were complaining about like other borders around the world. Often one of the challenges they have is that the borders are more like bureaucracies, or I mean, in a way that all borders are like bureaucracies, but in the sense that like they just shuffled papers and they didn't have the same powers as the U.S. Border Patrol. And what they meant by that, like one of the officials who did not allow me to use his name, he said that that the U.S. CBP or Border Patrol is quote unquote exempt from the Fourth Amendment, right? So that the Border Patrol can, you know, question you. They can, you know, the right to search, not to be searched or seized is.
Yeah,
you know,
they can like take your property. Yeah.
Right. Search through everything, interrogate you, detain you and interrogate you. And they're saying, well, some of these other borders, they don't have these powers. So essentially what they were trying to say is, we want these, you know, one of the things we want is these new border patrols to have these what we would call in the U.S. an extra constitutional powers to like stop people and suspend their rights. And
this must be what they mean when they say like they want America to export its democracy.
Yeah.
It's like exporting like border democracy. Wow, like border dictatorship. Jesus Christ.
It's like exporting border dictatorship. Yeah, that's what alludes to, like, so you get this like entire world of where essentially, you know, like you're creating zones and border zones, and like in the US we have that jurisdiction of the 100 mile zone, where it's ACLU calls the constitution free zone. And essentially what you think is, well, that's what they want to, you know, that's what they're thinking of doing, and, you know, or pressuring other countries to do as well. And then essentially what it creates are zones of exception, right? Or zones in a constant state of an emergency just because of the border, where officials have rights to just to like stop you, interrogate you, detain you, arrest you, expel you from their country. And then it essentially becomes a war zone, because people, like if you think about how people migrate, you know, they avoid the security apparatus, right? They go around it. So it ends up in like people going through real desolate territories. And through what essentially is a war, it becomes, you know, a variety of war zones that are spread out throughout planet Earth, really. And that's what it seemed. That's the direction we seem to be headed with this.
One thing that you're very clear about in your book too, which is that we shouldn't just view this issue as one of safety and security, that actually it's linked to global capitalism and the growth of wealth inequality, which, you know, you give statistics in your book about how extreme it's becoming, and show that very clear, that, you know, just throw out one statistic that you have here. In 1960, people living in the world's richest countries were 33 times wealthier than those living in poor countries. But by 2000, the difference has quadrupled. So, and what I want to see if you can talk about a little bit here is how people who are in these countries, particularly you spend time on Mexico, they are actually involved in providing cheap labor potentially for creating the security state apparatuses built along these borders, for working for these companies that are involved in churning out these tools of control, and how little they're being paid for what they're doing. You talk about Nogales and how people, a line worker, is making an average pay of 800 pesos per week. And I'll just read what you wrote here. With the exchange rate hovering in 2017 at around 18 pesos to the dollar, that amounts to $44 for a whole week on the assembly line. To buy a gallon of milk and a carton of 12 eggs, each costing about 43 pesos or $2.40 at the Nogales supermarket, well, you would have to work 4.5 hours. To understand what that means in US terms, it would be like spending $32 for your eggs and milk on a minimum wage of $7.25. So I won't read it all. People can get the book from Verso if they want to see the rest. But like, it's very vivid what you present here, that that this very rich thing of the people who are being controlled are actually building the tools of their oppression, possibly.
Yeah, that's I think that's exactly what's happening, which is mind-boggling in a lot of ways, right? Like for example, there's to give a local example from where I live in Tucson, Arizona, and it's the University of Arizona is in Tucson, Arizona, and they have a tech park. The tech park is one of the things about this tech park is that they want to, the CEO of this tech park has said, we want to build the biggest cluster of border security corporations or businesses in North America, and so the idea with this they started this whole like program, and it's called Global. Geez, now I'm forgetting the name. Global. It's like I forget the exact name of it, but it's a global program attracting companies from all over the world to come and set up shop in the southern Arizona to create this cluster of border surveillance border apparatus companies, and the whole part of this program is to then connect them with this company that sets up manufacturing in Mexico, so like maquiladoras or factories. So basically, you know, there's a number of different sectors they work in, but one of them clearly is border, and they have a special one for Israel called the Israel Business Initiative. And so they look for Israeli companies, like privileged Israeli companies, and then say an Israeli company that makes, and I use this example in the book, makes night vision goggles, is interested in searching out the U.S. market. They could come to Southern Arizona, set up shop, then hook up with this manufacturing company who would then send the production to Mexico and Guaymas, in this case, Guaymas, Mexico, just a couple hours south of the border. There, you know, people making, again, what, you know, 800 pesos or $44 a week will be making night vision goggles, and that will then be shipped back to, you know, the United States or to Israel. And then they will, then possibly those very same night vision goggles will be sold to the U.S. Border Patrol, who will then use them to possibly see, monitor, surveil, and possibly arrest the very same workers for their pathetic wages, who would be possibly crossing the border, and using the very night vision goggles that they themselves manufactured in Mexico. And that's the kind of like Homeland Security meets NAFTA, right? Or like the globalization, global capitalism meets Homeland Security, and everyone's like an actor in a certain sense. So that's the kind of like scenario of that's being played out, like the people making the components of these, you know, border surveillance systems or even military systems of many types are, you know, generally like people working in these factories in places like Mexico or anywhere else around the world. And it doesn't even have to be through this program, right? Like in Nogales, you could just drive around and see one of the there's 100 factories there of mostly U.S. corporations, and a lot of them are making electronic components. And they're not supposed to make the whole system, so they make components of it, and then the components of like a national security system gets sent back to the U.S. and then somebody else puts it all together, and so that dynamic is definitely happening. And so this idea of like, you know, who can, it also brings up, you know, these, who can cross a border and who can't cross a border. And, you know, those sorts of, you know, there's all kinds of issues that are brought up with this.
This is Global Advantage, right? Isn't that what we're trying to reach for?
I just wanted to say, like, I think this speaks to something that is like very clear throughout your book, which is like, you have two groups of people in the world. And one of them is a small group of people who do travel and can travel freely. And I was actually really stunned. I mean, this is actually in the opening of your book, but this still like got me. I mean, I know obviously like as Americans, we're very privileged that we can travel like almost anywhere without a visa. But you say that if you're from the US, UK, France, or Germany, among other several other countries, you can freely travel to approximately 160 countries without a visa, which is great for us. But then you talk about people from other countries who can only travel to like maybe 30 other countries without a visa, depending on where they're from. And then you mention how, even though like a lot of people use air travel, something like only 6% of the global population actually gets on like a flight. Is that right?
Yeah.
Only six. Yeah. Only 6%
according of the to that population one, yeah.
boards an airplane in any given year. And you say there's a yawning global gap in wealth, just like there's a yawning global gap in wealth. There's also an enormous chasm between those who have freedom of movement and those who do not. And so I think this is really important to mention because it's like all of the border apparatus you're talking about is used to like prevent most people in the world from being able to move freely. And like when you're talking about the borders you visit, it's like, you know, I travel all the time. I never have to go through a land border, like except for when I go to Syria, maybe. Like, I never have to go through a land border. I go in a plane. So it just like even just speaks to like the fact that like people are having to like walk to other countries. I guess so. Can you kind of speak to like the way that all of this is like literally to benefit like elite so that they can go wherever they want, wherever while everyone else like is stuck because they're too poor.
Yeah, I think that's the crux of this. It's like to conceptualize like, oh, the border is a, you can think of it a border, or you can think of it a border system, and then you can think of it a global border system. And when you think of it as a global border system, then it becomes sort of this like scaffolding of the status quo, really, of a business as usual, of like, and business as usual is where, like, you know, certain sector people, but mainly, you know, huge companies or corporate operations can cross the borders whenever they want, wherever they want. There's no, you know, there's no border patrol. You know, if you're a mining company and you're going to Mexico, like hundreds of them, or Central America. This is one of those topics that needs to be discussed a little bit more about Central America, I would guess. But if you're a mining company that's going to Central America or Mexico, and you're going and you're taking over an entire swaths of land, and you're poisoning water with cyanide, as often happens, or there's toxic waste, you know, being left from your operations, or what you bring is really pathetically paid jobs and really dangerous jobs to local people, if anything, and you're causing like damage, and often irreparable damage, and damage that's damaging and even displacing people, but there's nothing stopping you from going. You're doing it in the broad daylight. You're going, there's no ICE that's going to go round you up and throw you in detention centers, or there's no expulsion from the countries. There's no border patrol stopping you. There's nothing. All of this has been erased for you, right? You can just do whatever you please for profit, right? For the bottom line, and to keep what a global economy, whose quote unquote health is, you know, like the GDPs of every country, you know, going up and up and up. And so you have complete system of open borders for elite, these sorts of business corporations. And also, like, if you think about it, the U.S. military has open borders. Now the border apparatus has no open borders to go wherever it really pleases. And so what happens is that, like, when you have this, then the business as usual system is one where, you know, a lot of people, you know, it drives a lot of people, and it marginalizes huge amounts of people, drives, you know, pays them as like the maquila workers we were just talking about, $44-$45 a week, or unsustainable wages. In Mexico, like, the agricultural policies have just really displaced so many small farmers who can't compete with U.S. grain movers and as far as corn. So this kind of free market economy has really been destructive, and really it's really causing displacement. And then you add onto that, you know, like the climate crisis and that whole, you know, dynamic of places in ecological collapse, and the kind of droughts you're seeing in like Mexico and Central America and that sort of thing. And you have this, you know, and so you have people being displaced, but in order for this kind of business as usual system to keep going on, there has to be like a system of also containment. And that's what it seems like this border system is. It's like the scaffolding to keep, to make sure like everything can keep going as it is going. And there, and then the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and everything gets more and more screwed, really. And so
it sounds so like incredibly dystopian. And one thing that like, a lot of people don't realize is like for the rich people of countries that are like of Central America, the rich people of Central America can travel to the US quite easily. Yes. This is a certain kind of person that's being kept out. And you even talk about it in your book about like the visa process itself. And that's one thing I've noticed living in Lebanon is like when my friends try to get a visa to the US, they have to give them their bank account information to show they have money. Like you can't get a visa to the US unless you have like a bank account or own a bunch of shit.
Yeah. That's like, the same. So
I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the same. It seems that's the same anywhere. Like in Mexico, same thing. You have to show a bank account. Like, you have to show like, you have to prove that you're not going to stay in the United States. Right. That's what
Or that you're not a poor person. Basically, to prove that you're not poor.
Exactly. That's what you're essentially proving.
So before we move to another region, I do want to ask about an extraordinary exchange that you witnessed. I hope you're able to shed some light on this, because this was incredible, as it was incredible to you, that you were at a Homeland Security convention and this person from Goldcorp, a Canadian company, stood up and apparently was complaining to a foreign government and asking for help from a foreign government to help them protect their own interests from a local protests. I mean, the way you described it was like this was something you never really had witnessed before, but it really brought home how internationalized this border system is.
Yeah, that's that. That was really surprising to me. I mean, it's one of those things that you like. Well, yeah, that's that's clearly what's happening, right? I want it, but to see it happen in right in front of my face at this. I was in Mexico City at one of these huge security conventions, and to see like, the person pretty much say, ask the Mexican government, ask a police commander from the Mexican government about the corporation he was representing, Goldcorp, which is in the state of Zacatecas in Mexico, he said, well, we're having trouble with, I forget the wording, but it made it almost sound like it was organized crime. You know, he went that route. So you think it's some sort of, instability caused by, a cartel or something like that. And then, upon research after and looking really into, this part of Zacatecas where this gold corp is and seeing there's been, an uproar in the local population. And in fact, they've taken over the mine like a few times. They blockaded it. The kind of great activism that really, putting their bodies on the line sort of activism. And it's clearly that's what he was talking about, because it stops down their operations. You look into their, they complain about the local population. And then one of the last ones was an actual, it was discovered in 2014 that there's toxic waste being dumped in their water supply, and that the people in the community have been drinking this contaminated water for a couple years, and nobody said anything about it, and Goldcorp knew about it. So that's an example of just the environmental damage. But then here we are at this Homeland Security convention, and then you have this real, this what would be real security, right? The idea that, oh, the people in this community should be getting clean water to drink, to what is really Homeland Security is about, which is this company representative saying, hey, police guy, we're having trouble. We need, this idea. And it really was a border convention. So it was the commander was from a Mexican police unit that was borders was a big part of it, but it was also, it was borders slash infrastructure. So what they meant by infrastructure was any sort of huge mega project going on in the country, which meant like hydroelectric dam projects. But it also meant, it clearly meant, you know, mining operations like this. He said it himself. So they started talking about what was called a business front, right? A business front, right? So it's like this idea that business, like this Goldcorp and this Homeland Security unit in Mexico would be combining forces to have this front that would be protecting their business, which was in itself an extension of the border. But even though it wasn't on the border, right? We're talking inland Mexico. So I thought, you know, like you said, I think that was really a revealing moment, and a revealing moment that also is very revealing about what this thing is, right? What is this border, global border apparatus? What is it? What does it mean? What is it for? Who is it for? Who is it protecting? And who is it? Like not only marginalizing but brutalizing it often.
You have to in a way, like if you're going to be brutalizing people like this, you have to then build a militarized apparatus to keep them out, because they're going to run away from the like dirty water
exactly
that you made dirty, and they're going to run away from like the violence you caused, and they're going to run away from like the shitty wages that you forced on them.
Exactly. And I think that's it. That's one of the reasons behind it, clearly.
Now, before we conclude, we want to have you talk about, you went to the border, the Syrian border, and you were looking at, you wanted to figure out what a lot of this money that's been going to the Jordanians is being used for. There's like $300 million, probably more at this point as we're talking, but these funds there for them to build this project to do border security. And we know, we've seen very vividly the refugee crisis, the displacement caused by the conflict in Syria, and Raytheon Corporation being involved in this contract. Can you talk about what you found in pursuing this?
Jordan is really putting a huge emphasis on its border, particularly with Syria, also with Iraq. They've been working on, they're on phase three of a three-phase border enforcement program that various companies have been involved, U.S. companies. DRS Technologies was the first company that got a contract with Jordan. And DRS Technologies is always interesting because they're based here in Tucson for a little bit, and they had a motto on that. I have to paraphrase it again, sorry, but it's like you draw the line and we'll secure it. That was their motto, and that was one of the first companies contracted by the Jordanian government with a lot of U.S. funds going into Jordan, and then Raytheon got, you know, then ended up getting a bigger contract. And what they're doing is basically constructing an electronic wall, kind of very similar to the integrated fixed tower system we have on the U.S.-Mexico border. And interestingly enough, the integrated fixed tower system comes from, you know, is being built by the Israeli company Elbit Systems on the U.S.-Mexico border. But not in on the Syrian border with Jordan, it's Raytheon that's pretty much building this same sort of system, this composed of towers with these high tech cameras that can see so super far away that feed into command and control centers, and then there's a Jordanian border patrol that will be alerted to what's happening And so that's basically what I was looking into there. There's a lot of in the broader sense, it's just another, as we think about the whole multi-layered border system. Well, there's another one, right? Like this, it's not just in the Western Hemisphere, but it's just expanding way, you know, way far, far away from the U.S. mainland to you know, the Jordan, Syrian border, the Jordan, you know, like following in a sense, what I guess that big argument, what U.S. empire, right? The imperial expanse of what the U.S. border is, where it is, where, you know, as it like quote unquote secures key geostrategic areas, right? Like as some of the officials put it, and Jordan, you know, is just another one of those places that's and they're getting considerable training from the U.S. and getting all kinds of funds and it's really a similar process, but in that different context.
Right, it's like not to immediately keep people necessarily out of getting close to the U.S. because you've got like an ocean for that.
Right.
So it has like a bit of a different function, I guess. That's interesting though about like them building basically the same technology. I imagine geopolitically, like even though Jordan and Israel are technically at peace or whatever, the people of Jordan would not be so thrilled if like the Israelis were doing business at their border. They still have some integrity.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. He said I interviewed a major general who was like the top guy from the Jordanian border patrol, I guess at one point. He had recently retired. And he had this, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's like he said, because of us, you would have to give Israel six, I forget what he said, something like you'd have to give, the United States would have to give Israel $5 billion a year instead of $3 billion. he said something like that. It was something like remarking about how their border system was.
I mean, he probably also, I imagine that this guy probably also means to an extent like keeping the crazies at bay. Jordan sees itself as like, well, a lot of these like Middle East, like authoritarian states see themselves as being the preventer of like Al Qaeda taking over the region or something. But
yeah,
I like how that like
went on that. He talked quite a bit of
I mean, that's a bit a little off topic. Like Jordan of all places it's like a funny thing for a Jordanian to be saying, considering like the kind of shit Jordan teaches in their schools. Like their schools have gotten increasingly conservative to a point of like people coming out of them like just like being really intolerant. So anyway, but so, I mean, since we're talking about the Middle East, I guess the next place we should maybe mention is Israel. You also talk quite a bit about Israel, and we've talked to you on the show before about that, about like Israel's role, and you've written about this, of Israel's role in like being one of the, you know, being at like the forefront of border technology and how a lot of its border technology stuff is being used at the U.S.-Mexico border. But I guess like what new things do you have to say about Israel's role in all of this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I was looking at Israel, you know, going to Israel was in the book was looking at its, you know, how it is a leader in this global, global market or global business, homeland security business, right? The Israel, you know, so looking primarily from that angle and I went and I was able to go to, you know, like a couple of those, you know, technology expositions, like homeland security conventions that you know, we discussed in other places. But this one, I went to one in Tel Aviv, for example, and it was done by this company. I guess I'll call it a company. I guess they might call themselves an organization. I call them a company. It's called Israeli Homeland Security, and they put on this drone exhibition. And so you go in there, and there's all these companies that are you know, selling drones. And the big thing that they were looking at were what they call the unmanned ground vehicles. So they're pretty much like robots or big, you know, Humvee-looking armored vehicles that would be patrolling borders. And that was a selling point in this particular convention. Just going there and seeing how things are being, presented is interesting in its own right. Like going to the, there's a constant demonstrations and how, like I went to the back and there was a demonstration going on of this little robot called the Dogo, and it was just, there was a person that was giving the demonstration. He was talking in like really a perfect American English, right, with that American accent. And so obviously he was talking to
an Israeli native.
right. But he was not, he was like definitely talking to an international market, right? And this Dogo was like this little black box that was like buzzing around. And almost, if you just look at it and be like, oh, wow, that's cute, right? That's like a poodle or something. Or, it was just like buzzing around. And then all of a sudden he said, okay, let's weaponize it. And he pointed to this other guy, and this other guy like brings a handgun out of his pocket. And
Jesus Christ!
I know. I thought the same thing. He clicks it into the Dogo, and then all of a sudden the Dogo's, and the way the sun was shining, you could even see like the gleam of the barrel of the gun. Now as a Dogo was like buzzing around, then all of a sudden it really wasn't so cute anymore, and it was just is that thing armed? And so this guy was he was talking about that, and at the same time there was an orbiter drone flying over us. So he kept referencing that. And then it turns out the orbiter drone, like how they were selling that was that the orbiter could do surveillance missions. So you point up and he'd say, you can't hear it, because that was the big thing about the orbiter. Like, you can't hear it, but there it is. And you'd look up and see this drone floating over you. And he said, well, you can, it'll like do like 2 hours of surveillance. And then the dramatic pause, then it could dive bomb a target, right? So it was like a suicide drone. So those are examples, right? Like
these people sound like the worst people in the world. Like I hope at one of these security expos, like all of their machinery just attacks them, like by accident, or like someone hacks it. Someone hacks it. So like then I want to. Then you can see like a real show of what their equipment does. I mean, seriously, like what the hell? It's so dystopian. You've got like a bunch of like elite assholes in a building trying to sell death machines, and they're just like acting like it's a bunch of teddy bears. Like, wow, look at my new toy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it's getting to the point where these things could attack, right? Like the Dogo could accidentally go off, right? The orbiter could accidentally dive bomb. Yeah.
The CEO was killed today by his own suicide drone.
Yeah.
entertaining headline.
Yeah. so essentially, yeah, that would be quite the headline, wouldn't it? But anyhow, like Israel's just, they have so many of these startup companies that are coming often from ex-soldiers or all these startups that are creating these new technologies that they're like the innovator, right? They're the, when talking to the guy in Southern Arizona about the cluster, the biggest cluster in North America, he's like, well, I said, why not the world? And he said, well, that's how are we going to top Israel, right? Israel is the cluster of homeland security in the world. That's where it's at. And
isn't it a lot of it like funded by American aid? Like,
yeah.
Like Israel uses American aid to like, they have like a special exemption where instead of having to spend all of it on US technology firms, they can like spend it on their own.
Yeah. Almost everywhere else in the world, if you get U.S. assistance, you have to like use that money you have to buy your technologies from U.S. companies or buy whatever your weapons from U.S. companies. Israel's the exception. I think but it's not a total exception. It's like they can use 25% or
Yeah. 25% of like $3 billion.
Yeah.
Is quite a bit of money. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're using US aid for these reasons, you know, and then you think of it that way, and then you think this is the main place where things are propagating. So how the kind of border systems that are put around and in and pervasive throughout Israel-Palestine, especially in the occupied territories, is what is then being exported to the world. So you're bringing like that exporting that, like when you have the combined like special U.S.-Israeli relationship, and the U.S. is like pushing out its borders, and then you have the technologies that are really either coming from Israel or really inspired a lot, like the Raytheon integrated fixed towers. That was inspired by Elbit Systems doing that on the West Bank, right? So you know, you have you're bringing these technologies from the occupied territories you're globalizing it, right? And so that's what I was looking at mainly, you know, this that and really globalizing apartheid, right? Even talking to people from South Africa and talking about apartheid, and hearing like people from South Africa talk about Israel, the currency of Israel, like this, even when you're talking about the apartheid system in South Africa, it's almost nothing compared to what they're doing here. The kind of technological systems, the checkpoints, the walls, the highways where one person, you know, you can only drive on them if you have certain license plates, and others where you can't, right? This whole system set up is worse, right? You know,
because it's apartheid. It's like apartheid for the 21st century.
Exactly. And that apartheid for the 21st century is being exported from there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
as
just,
you
like limited.
As you were detailing in your book, you quoted an activist from Israel, Jeff Halper, who said it's basically selling the security state, and to not think of it just as selling a border wall or selling border surveillance, but like actually a way that you can control people very deep, very far into the country, even miles inland away from these border zones. So we want to conclude this segment, but first I'll let people know that if they want to get a copy of your book, they can go to Verso Books and purchase a book from there, or I'm sure it's available at all books at most major bookstores, right, Todd?
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Like a Barnes and Noble or.
Yeah.
And
I even saw it on Walmart. I was like, God.
Well, maybe you might convert somebody.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
So we're going to wrap this here, and then we're going to do some bonus material that we'll post separately. So I thank you all.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening. But also, if you want to listen to the bonus material, become a fucking patron.
Rania's always so aggressive towards people.
You think that's why that's why people aren't becoming patrons? Like, keep threatening them.
Yeah, you need to like tone it down, because they think that like they're actually being like we're punishing them for not becoming patrons. I don't think that's. I think we have to like do some off air conversation
about how I'm pitching this. I need like an intervention.
What you're hearing is just the raw enthusiasm of Rania for our show, and that's how it gets translated. It sounds like a demand for you to give us money now.
Or else. Don't forget the or else.
All right. Well, we're going to stop here. And again, thank you, Todd, for joining us. And hopefully we have you on again soon for further discussion, because there's definitely much more in the book that we didn't get to here for our wider audience.
Thank you. It's so great to be on. Thanks.